This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Van McCoy grew up in Mount Airy, North Carolina, a town many affectionately know as Mayberry. In fact, Andy Griffith lived 4 hours away from his father. But Van's life would take him very far from the little town and traditions that he grew up in. Spent half of his life as a monk, chanting, praying, and traveling the world, teaching social entrepreneurship. After 25 years as a monk, he returned home to Mount Airy and is now making moonshine. Apparently, we have some explaining to do, and Van McCoy is here to help fill in all of those gaps. Van McCoy, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about growing up in Mayberry. What was that like for you?
Well, it was a very different place at that time than it is now. It's grown and developed during my 30-year absence, but small hometown America, very much that quintessential American hometown. And I went to the public school there, Mount Airy High School, but was anxious to move on to the big world and the big city and that kind of thing. So eventually transitioned beyond that. Coming back to it, is certainly a change. Not only have I changed, but it's changed as well.
Well, I want to hear about everything that's happened in between. Was Mount Airy aware of itself as Mayberry when you were growing up?
Not really. It was just getting started by the time I had left for college to take on that persona of the Mayberry from the television show, more as a tourism aspect to draw some people in.
And for people who don't know, it wasn't the producers of that show, but in fact, the lead actor, Andy Griffith, who is from Mount Airy and whose really artistic vision was to create a town that was very much like the place he grew up in. He did grow up and, I understand, had a crush on your mom.
Well, at least as mother tells it, he would come in and chase her around the soda fountain, Hollingsworth Soda Fountain, where she was a soda jerk at the time. They were 16. And I guess my dad went out, or Andy could have been my dad. We'll see.
Her name wasn't Helen, was it?
No, it was okay. Bertie May.
What, really? Bertie May. You got the May.
There you go.
The May. Oh, wow. So you talked about the changes and the ways in which you knew pretty early on that you didn't, that small town life was probably not going to be it for you forever. Like at the tender age of 6 when you have your first existential crisis.
Yes, that was interesting. I remember walking home from school. It was Jones Elementary, and I was close enough to walk. Came home from first grade one day, and all I can remember is I came in. My mom was still away at work at that time, and I came in and dropped my book bag on the floor and sat down on the couch and cried my eyes out. And I don't know what triggered it. I've tried in the years to figure out exactly where the trigger was, but I was crying because I realized I couldn't learn everything there was to know. I didn't have the time to learn it all, to figure it all out, to understand it, to comprehend it. And that was a crisis. That was a crisis. It lasted for a minute or two or three for the crying portion. And then I just had this realization, again, I suppose somewhat precocious for a six-year-old at the time, but that, well, okay, so time is the factor, and what time I do have, I need to use wisely and choose only the best things to learn and to apply myself to. And I think in many ways that was the catalyst for the next, 20 years of my life that was driving me to forego certain things to pursue better things.
And to be clear about this, this is the kind of thing that can happen to somebody in New York City. It's not about the where you are. This is more in this moment is more about who you are than where you're from, right?
Exactly.
So we
exactly.
need to separate those. This is not just about being in a small town. It's about this sense that there's a big wide world out there. It's full of information and it needs to get into your head.
And I want to know it all. I need to know it all. And I think, you know, I'm a lifelong learner. And that was the sign of it for me, is that I had this incredible wonder about all things, and I wanted to investigate it all, but I couldn't.
Couldn't. So did you have a sense of what that meant for you? Did you instantly in that moment flash on a career path? I must be a...
Not really. I just knew that I wanted to study all the whys of how things worked. And I think what happened at that point was... Carl Sagan came out with Cosmos, And my mother and I watched that together. My parents were divorced when I was six. So my mother and I would watch that together. And I think it was really that seed and that timing, you know, in the late 70s, where the wonder of the universe and all of those things was coming about. And I wanted to be Carl Sagan.
You started out in chemistry, experimenting with distillation properties of various chemicals.
Well, yes. It started actually just before that, when I was, I believe it was 13. I had gone to a summer camp for kids. It was a six-week program at Western North Carolina, out in Cullowhee. And that particular year, the theme happened to be Appalachian culture. So we learned to clog and to play the dulcimer and ghost stories and all of that kind of thing. And there was a little blurb section, if you will, on part of the region's history was involved with moonshine and making alcohol and selling it and corn in a bottle kind of thing. It was really more just learning about it. But I came home, and I guess you could say even at that age I was very much a closet engineer, and started poking around at things and said, well, it can't be that hard. So I found some cornmeal under the cupboard and a 5-gallon bucket and packet of bread yeast and kind of added what sugar was left in the sugar bowl to it and put it on the back porch where mother wouldn't see it when she opened the door. About a week later, my mother comes home from work, and I'm in the kitchen. And I had taken her pressure cooker. I found some copper pipe in the basement in my little toy shop of playthings, and I puttied it to the pressure cooker and ran it over into the sink and ran the cold water over it, and that was my condenser. And I was standing there when she walks in, and she says, "Vandalism, what are you doing?" And I just looked at her with a twinkle in my eye, and she put her hand on her hip, and she said, "Are you making liquor?" And I just kind of nodded, yes, not quite knowing what was going to happen next. She burst out laughing, and she says, "Well, I guess you can't help it. I've never told you, but I suppose it's time. Your grandparents and cousins were either making it or selling it in three counties for the last 150 years. It must be in your blood." So that's how it all started.
You come from a long line of moonshiners.
I guess I do.
Did you find out any more about them?
I didn't. Okay. Unfortunately, that was really the end of the conversation. And yeah. It was, you know, interestingly, my parents weren't drinkers. I didn't grow up in a drinking culture. And so I don't know, but it must have been the gene that skipped.
It's a business. You never use this stuff. You just run it back and forth. But I'm also fascinated to hear that by the age of 13, you had already earned the nickname Vandalism.
Well, that was Mother's pet name for me. I really didn't do any bad things. I was okay. A pretty good kid, but yes, it was perhaps a sign of things to come, at least in my approach to the world.
Now, at some point, and maybe it's from this point on, that you decide that astrophysics might be a way to channel some of this inquiry that you had.
True. Again, I had that impetus from watching Cosmos and Carl Sagan, and that was kind of where things were. I purchased and got at my home Discover magazine and Popular Science and Scientific American. Those were my reading things after school. So I was heading in that science and math direction at that point. Interestingly, the School of Science and Math had just opened, and everyone at my school, including myself, thought, well, that's where he's going to go. And I got to the finals but didn't get in. And that was a surprise, actually, to all of us. And at that point, I said, well, what am I going to do next? And I was a junior in high school at the time. And so I sat about looking at other possibilities. I ended up quitting high school when I was 16 and was accepted in the early admissions program at Georgia Tech to study astrophysics. So my plan had been to go to Georgia Tech and then either to MIT or Caltech to learn the real whys of the universe.
At the age of 16. And
correct.
Your mom let you go.
She did. You know, I'd gone to all these summer camps from early ages. I wasn't a homebody. It wasn't about staying at home. And from a broken home anyway, it wasn't like there was a deep kind of nuclear family going on.
And you lost your dad at a young age, right?
Correct. I was 15 and He went in for a hernia operation from work, and post-op, they discovered something funny in the blood, and within 20 days, he had died of acute leukemia. Mm. So that was a surprise and another shock for me at the time.
But it meant that you were home. I mean, again, thinking about your mom, you are maybe not a close nuclear family, but you know, you're all that's left of that family, and she saw something, huh?
And I should say, even from the beginning, my mother was incredibly supportive of myself. I had an older brother who had already gone off to college. He died back in the 90s, but he was also gifted in many ways and had gone off actually to Davidson here in North Carolina. But she wanted me to pursue whatever I felt drawn to. She was encouraging and knew that she had a special kid she needed to open the world to and not keep them. Keep her at home and not have the apron strings too tight.
We will find out what happened when Van did leave home and didn't come back for many, many years. Van McCoy, owner and operator of Mayberry Spirits in Mount Airy. Just ahead, the hunt for answers to life's biggest questions. We'll do that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Statio, talking with Van McCoy, owner of Mayberry Spirits in Mount Airy, North Carolina. But before he was making spirits, he was feeding spirits. Spent 25 years as a monk, and we're talking about that. We'll hear about his life in the monastery, but first, I want to hear about life at Georgia Tech studying astrophysics. How'd that go?
Well, I ended up not staying very long, a semester or two, and was quickly disillusioned, actually, with the big college atmosphere. And it could have been any big college in America. And what I figured out, and again, you know, I was 16 at the time, was I wanted to know about the whys of the universe, but I was being taught formulas simply to describe some of the hows that how things occurred. And I wanted more than that. So I left Georgia Tech and ended up at a small classical liberal arts school, Thomas Aquinas College, out in California, that's unique for having a great books program, and was immersed and surrounded in the great questions of humanity and of the universe, everything from reading Aristotle to Einstein or the theology of Thomas Aquinas or the philosophy of Hobbes or Berkeley or whomever, and it fed that desire. Again, that crisis of knowledge when I was six found its fulfillment in being able to study these things and to learn how to learn. So that was the initial part of the odyssey moving towards, shall we say, higher things.
Well, part of this, I mean, you talked about the sort of formulaic approach to, you know, sort of know the, here's what we already know, learn that. And you're thinking, well, no, how did they get there? When before we knew all that, how did they get there? And they're not telling you that. So that can be part of it. But then the humanities, this other question, you may remember a famous Twilight Zone where they're going to feed this computer and it knows all of the answers to the material universe. And then they ask it why and it blows up, right? So was that the big question for you? It's like, oh, wait a minute. How things work is not as important to me as why this is.
As why. And I think in that why came the bigger question of there's something bigger than the why. And it was, perhaps I should say, it was developing a relationship with the big other that somehow brought it all about. The big G, as I would often refer to God as. And that spiritual side of my life, which I'd never been particularly involved in. I grew up a kind of wishy-washy Methodist. I went to the Moravian Church and Methodist Church in Mount Airy, but it was never a central part of my life. So I was suddenly captivated by both the deep thinking theology that came through the Catholic tradition, but even more so was captivated by the spiritual tradition of mysticism, of beauty, of liturgy, of concern for the human soul and development of virtue. That attracted me. And more so than just explaining the universe, which many of these things did, and I was learning in my university education, it was what was important for the heart, how to develop the heart and to grow, I think, both in love and knowledge. So I moved from the pursuit of just knowledge, to know and to be wondered about, to wondering about life and the wonder of human relationship.
Tell me how that experience at Aquinas in California, what was that What was it about that place that fed that, and how did it feed that?
Well, one, you had a very small, intimate academic community. When I was there, we had 120 students. My graduating class was the largest ever at the time, of 33 from college. It was very much a Socratic dialogue method of digging into the texts and the knowledge of the people there. At the same time, the atmosphere of the college was very conducive for spiritual growth. It was run by lay people. It wasn't a religious order or anything. It was very much focused on these classical liberal arts. But, for example, with the options with Mass or other kinds of devotional things, it was in Latin, in Gregorian chant, with incense, with a polyphonic choir, all done by the students. And that drew me in. The beauty and the kind of the whole connection with the human person. I was captivated, and that was it.
Tell me more about this, because it's a fascinating paradox in some ways. The Catholic Church often comes in for a lot of criticism because of the ways in which these traditions are brought forward, these more mystical spiritual traditions, the smells and bells, as they like to say. If you strip all that away, then you get a guy with rules who sets the rules and just learn the rules that God set down, and you'll live a happy life. That's the other way you can approach this. What is it about? What do you think that carrying that forward has done? Because there's a way it can be misinterpreted. It can be considered superstitious and therefore distracting. On the other hand, it seems to have nurtured this quest in your mind and heart for some deeper meaning.
Absolutely, Frank. I think it's exactly that point of, I think the human soul is always looking for something deeper, not only for the answers to whys, but to how do I express love, goodness, beauty, truth, oneness, if you will, in the life around me. I think the mystical traditions that we find not only in Catholicism but in all the other major world religions, what we might call in the monastic or ascetic cultures that are there, express the desire of the human heart towards the divine. I think it's a draw towards the most beautiful, the most, if you will, knowledgeable or truth in the bigger sense of the word, the oneness of how everything is so interconnected, and to want to be an integral part of that and to find my place and to rejoice in that, to live that in a joyful way, to celebrate the beauty of everything.
This leads you to the monastery.
Absolutely. And I think that was what drew me in a very real way, was the monastic life, at least as I understood it at the time, was very much a pursuit of all these things, of all that was good and true and beautiful, and one with long tradition, thousands of years of tradition, of ways to help both the individual and the community as a whole to grow in their intimacy both with God and with one another, and to become as wonderful a human being as they could be.
Now, one of the criticisms of monastic life, and then one of the reasons that people find it off-putting and maybe not so attractive, is that it does seem it is precisely because it's sequestered. You are not, don't appear to be participating in the Sturm und Drang of everyday life. And so, you know, somebody might say, well, yeah, it's easy to find yourself there, but get out there and make a living. That's when it gets tough.
There is some truth to that. On the other hand, you are living in a community of other human beings, male or female, as the case may be. And you are put in front of the difficulties of the human soul and human development, the controversies, the crises, and not just between one another, but more so with yourself. I think pulling away, if you will, using the word sequester as you did, from all of the distractions of normal society or of the real world, if you want to call it that, gives us a chance to have to sit in the silence, on the silence of the heart, in the darkness, where bright lights are pointed in dark corners of our hearts, and we need to confront those things, to grow through them, to learn to embrace some of them, and to learn how to live with them. That is what I think the monastic life can do, is to provide the place, the ambiance, for you to grow and to be rooted. And once you're well-rooted, then you could be anywhere.
Yeah, and that, I think, is the flip side of that argument, which is if you think it's tough to be out there making a living, distracting yourself with what your boss said and what your coworker said, wait till you sit down in silence with yourself.
Precisely.
Was it tough for you?
In many ways, at the beginning, yes, I was young, I was idealistic, and had a lot to learn, not only about myself, but about how people in the world worked. But it fit me well. It fit me like a glove, like we saw many of the things from my past. It was really where I was drawn to, and I was swimming in it and enjoying it immensely. So I went from that crisis of knowledge as a young child, which really pushed me up into the point of joining the monastery, to, I guess, what would be kind of my next crisis, if you will, the crisis of compassion, because I had found ways of feeding that desire for wonder and knowledge, and now I was starting to discover the struggles of the human heart, the needs of people, the suffering that goes on everywhere, both in myself and those around me and around the world. And I had another moment, like the one at six. I was, I think, my early 20s, and I had another kind of existential moment of crying and saying, I can't help them all. I can't solve all the suffering, etc. And it was another one where time snuck in, that tick, tick, tick in my mind of, then I have to use my time as well as I can to be able to help in the best ways I can with what's in front of me. So know the best things, help in the best ways you can, and that really propelled me for the next 10 to 15 years of monastic life.
I want to learn about where that took you, but I want to come back and underscore and highlight something that you just said, because I think it puts a finger on another criticism of monastic life. The idea that, oh, well, you're just in it for yourself. You're sitting around contemplating your navel. What more narcissistic enterprise could there possibly be? But what you've just said here is that the journey into the self, inevitably, if you get there, leads to everybody. That oneness brings you into this vast sense of everybody else's need.
Yes, indeed. By turning inward for a while to learn about yourself, eventually that's going to pull you outward to others. And really it was very much that of learning to love and to be loved, to love others around you, to allow yourself to be loved by others, and particularly to be loved by God. That's usually the hardest one most people had. When I was doing counseling for so many years with others, it was really not so much about the interpersonal. It was about having each person be able to say that they welcomed the love that was coming from without. Those barriers were the hardest ones to break down for so many.
So talk about the enterprises, because you do this. This is part of monastic life, of course, prayer, contemplation, but there's also the daily life of keeping the monastery going. There's a business.
Exactly. And so many think that monasteries get money from Rome or something. They don't. They're all self-supporting. And so my initial work, for the most part, with the monastic life, my day-to-day labors, if you were about finding sustainable ways to support our life. And in that context, we were a very small monastery, the one I was primarily involved with for many years. And so we had to be creative. We didn't have large properties or hundreds of monks or lots of things that we could do with that. So we went in other directions, which were very timely for the time, both with technology and the way the modern market economy and capitalism works. So I started a number of companies. One was called Laser Monks, which was about selling toner and inkjet cartridges and office products to others. We didn't make them. We were middle monks selling.
Were they
these
little
to other
quills?
People.
They were just little quills.
Little
ink.
Quills and that moved very quickly. Yeah. Yes, with lots of little monks. Yes, and that did well for a while. We looked at starting a golf project with a major development that was going to be a Pete Dye golf course. We ended up not doing that because Laser Monks did well. We had projects of moving homes that were slated for destruction, so I would literally pick them up and move them all over, and this time Wisconsin, did 20 or 30 of those and resell them at below market value, but save the homes, make a little money, move them on. We had a special company called Benevolent, or Benevolent Brands, if you will, where various products were sold to support the good works related to them. Say our Benevolent Blends at the time was coffee, and the income from that supported the families who picked our coffee beans in the various countries with their medical and educational needs. Or our Benevolent Biscuits, the monks made doggy biscuits, and the income from that helped nonprofits that used animals to support people in various needs, all kinds of things like that.
And was this a requirement that whatever the proceeds or some fraction of the proceeds would have to be used in some way like that, some good cause?
Absolutely. Not only did it support the monastery, which was a nonprofit in and of itself, but income was used to support these various other kinds of good works around the world. So the monks weren't just unto themselves. It was always a reaching out to help others in various ways.
But you are creating businesses. This puts you in contact again with the outside world and having to think in ways that, you know, market strategists and commercial minds work. Does this create a tension for you with the sort of contemplative nature of monastic life?
At times it did. I had to learn to in some ways walk in both worlds, but at the same time, because I had become well rooted within that monastic persona, I could be anywhere and still be very present to God, the world, and others around me. But the business part of that, I think what I took from that, I was able to develop into really, if you will, a gospel of social entrepreneurism, of using a for-profit business method to support a nonprofit good work. It might have been the monastery. It could have been something else. The Girl Scouts have Girl Scout cookies as an example. So it was really a development of our 1,000-year of tradition of self-support to do good things with. And so I began preaching that really around the country and did some TEDx kinds of talks and became, if you will, the poster monk for social entrepreneurism.
And the flying monk at some point. Tell us about that.
I had started my flying lessons when I was 16 but didn't get to finish them. I'd done a few lessons at Georgia Tech, but when I joined the monastery, that course all fell away. And then a local man who ran the local general aviation division at an airport near us discovered that I was interested and had a pass, and he said, "We'll help you finish getting your license." So finished my license, and then I had someone to actually donate a plane. Eventually, actually, two planes were donated. And I used those to fly to the various speaking engagements I had. The airport was actually adjacent to the monastery property, so I could ride my bike and in 5 minutes be up and in the air and off trying to tell people how to make some money to do some good works with.
Including a trip to Paris where you met a woman at the Eiffel Tower.
Oh, I forgot about that one.
Not us.
Yes. My first trip to Paris, I was actually on my way back to the United States at that point, but had an evening and ended up wandering down to the Eiffel Tower all by myself. It was a beautiful evening, full moon, you know, the kind of the idyllic scene for Paris, and I'm up on the tower just admiring the lights of the City of Lights, and mentioned to a lady that was next to me, I said, "Oh, c'est magnifique, n'est-ce pas? You know, it's beautiful, isn't it?" And she said, "Why, yes, it is." And I said, "Oh, you're from the United States." She said, "Yes, I am." She said, "Are you?" And I said, "Yes." "Where are you from?" And I said, "Oh, I'm from a little town you will have never heard of." "Oh, tell me." And I said, "Well, I'm from Mount Airy, Mayberry." "Mayberry? I was just there auditing your J.C. Penney." So I, you know, in this idyllic moment, and I meet someone who has just come from my hometown to do an audit on my JCPenney.
Did you find out how the JCPenney survived it, I assume?
They did. Yeah. I don't know how that will continue into the future, given the current economy, but right, they did well at the time.
That's fascinating. So what about that? And how is, again, we talked about your mom at the age of 16. Now she's going to let you go. You're the family at this point. How is she dealing with all this? You've been gone for, you know, a couple of decades.
Well, as I said, she was very supportive and wanted me to do what drew me to be who I needed to be. So she was always very much behind me. It was hard on me in many ways, knowing that my mother was alone back in my hometown. But I felt at the time I was doing the right thing. I was pursuing the right things. I was helping people, doing good works, and becoming a better person. And she saw that and was very supportive, especially after she actually visited the monastery and got to know people. She was very supportive. And she sent us my baby grand piano I grew up with. She sent gifts and was always trying to help us out.
You say, "Just stop with the fruitcakes, Mom. We make our own."
There you go.
Forgive me. I've got two more Mayberry jokes and one more monk joke, and that's all you have to endure.
Okay. All right. I'm holding you to that.
And you. There was a monastery in Switzerland as well. We should point out that you were there for some
time. Correct. I was in Switzerland for approximately 4 years, studying Cistercian spirituality and at the University of Fribourg doing some of my graduate work in theology. So that experience living in a 12th century monastery, the church, I remember the stalls I was standing in the church when I first got there. This little boy from Mayberry shows up in Switzerland, and the stalls were finished in a very flamboyant style.
These are prayer stalls, we should
point out. Prayer
stalls
that we would stand in to sing back and forth the Gregorian chants in the 12th century church. The church was finished in 1138. The stalls that I was in were finished in 1292. And I said, oh my gosh, my country was just being discovered when there were monks chanting from these stalls. That was an eye-opener.
Great stuff. We're talking to Van McCoy, former monk. He lives in Mount Airy now. That's where he was from originally. He's the current owner of Mayberry Spirits, and we'll tell you how he got back home and started making moonshine when the state of things continues. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to Van McCoy, raised in a town many call Mayberry, Mount Airy, North Carolina. And that is where he lives now. But his life journey took him about as far from Floyd's Barbershop as a guy can get. He has returned to the area and is now distilling liquor. He owns Mayberry Spirits in Mount Airy, and we're about to get you home again. I mean, it's fascinating to think about this because you begin at the age of 16 studying astrophysics. You become a monk, and ironically, had you been a physicist, you might have been confined to a single laboratory for your entire career. Instead, you're a monk and travel the world.
Exactly. That was actually surprising to me, too. I thought I would be in a monastery and be there, but I ended up traveling the world throughout my monastic career, both in studies and in speaking to other people to inspire them in various ways.
And creating these businesses. So what brought you home? You're back in Mayberry.
Well, I discovered on visiting my mother at one point, this would have been 7 years ago, that her health was declining. I was a late child, so she was already getting older. She's 92 now, and that she was going to need some care. I was at a good point in my, if you will, monastic career that I needed a break, and it was time to step back from the responsibilities I had. And so I took some sabbatical time. I ended up going to Ireland to study Celtic spirituality and collect myself for the next part of my odyssey, and then moved back home to care for Mother until she would be smiling from the other side. She's currently in a nursing home, and I see her two or three times a day. But returned home to Mayberry after 30 years and needed something to do and wasn't sure what that was going to be. So I looked around. I saw that the wine industry had taken off in our region in a big way. Of course, craft brewing had gone on throughout the United States, and I thought, craft distilling might be a nice next move. I didn't have any direct experience with distilling, apart from my 13-year-old clandestine moment of getting caught in the act.
Well, in that distant family of yours.
That blood gene was running in me. And being in monasteries, which, of course, are known for making some of the world's best beers, wines, and spirits, I'd been around it, and so I knew it wasn't rocket science, and I said, this might be good. So I wanted to start something in my hometown that would add some jobs, that could help increase the tourism, and perhaps even add to the cultural level of the tourism by adding nice artisan products to the mix. So decided on doing craft distilling. Initially, the focus there was on trying to get the business up and going, which is not so easy because of the regulations having to do with alcohol, particularly in North Carolina. But the thought at the beginning had to do more with, we have a tradition of moonshine in our region, and that's kind of a new fad. Let's go with that. You know, moonshine from Mayberry. And that was initially where we started as we were preparing it. But as we got into the program, and it was myself and a business investor and, you know, one or two other people along the way, discovered that we really were more about being a boutique distillery, about making unique products within North America. And the problem for me at that point was to take my monastic background and to try and imbue this company with that idea of social entrepreneurism, of making this company something that would be good for the community and would make quality products that people could enjoy. So my idea in using the word Mayberry in our name was to take that spirit of Mayberry, pun both intended and actually used, And that sense of the spirit of family, spirit of friendship, the spirit of celebration, all those things that gather us together to enjoy life, those are the things I wanted to produce. So we started out actually by producing a unique single malt sorghum whiskey, which has a much smoother finish and cleaner mouthfeel than traditional whiskeys.
I'm going to stop you there. Sure. Forgive me, but is that sorghum instead of corn?
Yes. So there's no corn, oats, rye, or barley, which is traditional in most whiskeys. We went entirely with sorghum. It's the most sustainable grain on the planet, 30 to 80% less water usage and drought resistant, and it's gluten-free. So there were a lot of cool qualities that went with it, apart from it being actually the taste was incredible. That was the first foray into the distilling part. Similarly, we took that and we used the alcohol to make the world's only single malt sorghum grain-based unique baking extracts with Madagascar, Tahitian vanillas. And then we used some of those to pour back into our aged whiskey to get a toasted vanilla version. We took some of the whiskey and had a Honduran family hand-roll cigars for us. And so we have infused hand-rolled cigars. We have fresh Honduran coffee roasted for us that has been soaked in our whiskeys. And then the rest of our retail area is entirely given to artisan products of North Carolina artists. Everything from handmade soaps to hand-turned woods to hand-blown glass, from Asheville up through the Appalachians and on. So really turned it into this wonderful little treasure trove of exciting things. But more importantly was what we tried to do with our tours. I wanted to create an experience for people. I wanted people to have a place where they came, learned something that was fun and interesting, and went away with that spirit of Mayberry, both in their hearts and hopefully in their hands and on their tongues.
You talk about the experience of all of this, the experience of sort of buying the product and the various the ingredients that go into it. Does it employ many people?
Right now, I have approximately 8 different people employed, some part-time, some full-time, and I'm more than full-time.
And you also have a YouTube channel, I guess, to teach people how to make their favorite drinks.
We do. We have a YouTube channel at Mayberry Spirits that will do craft cocktails and learn how to use various things at your home bar. It's a lot of fun. Check it out.
Now we did talk about the lure of actual monastic life, contemplative life, which you can have in the comfort of your own home if you want, if you just take that time to push away the distractions. I will say that alcohol could be one of those distractions in life if you're promoting this kind of thing. I mean, is there any kind of a conflict in that?
No, not actually. We were afraid when we opened, being in the deep Bible Belt, that we would have some pushback against making liquor in Mayberry. But obviously, from my tradition, alcohol was part and parcel to the lifestyle. You drank wine at table, and even in celebration of Mass or Eucharist, you had wine for communion. It wasn't about the indulgence in that. Mm. Everything in moderation was always our theme, and you can be immoderate in anything, from Doritos to the internet. Alcohol can be one of those. The point is using things in a way that is conducive to creating community and to enjoying life, and alcohol in the proper way to celebrate life, to offer a toast, a drink to remember, both happy or sad. That's part of the human condition.
Yeah, there is that Benedict and brandy that we all know about,
so and Dom Perignon as well.
And I think it also brings us back to this way of integration. Once you've taken the time to figure out who you are, and then when you find out that you are everything, right? Once you've taken that time, then you can go out and bring that sensibility to your life as a business person, your life as a distiller, that there's really nothing off limits. What was it, Augustine, who said, I think, love God first and then do whatever you want, or something like that?
Exactly, yeah. Love God and do what you will. Once you've been well-rooted in knowing who you are, you're in touch with your head and your heart and sharing that with others and trying to seek the good of others, then what you do in the world is largely irrelevant as far as the actual day-to-day. It's how you're bringing that to the good of the world.
And the way you conduct yourself in that business will be guided by that. So you'll be a different sort of business person.
Exactly. You're pursuing profits, if you will, for the sake of good. I used to call it commerce with compassion.
And the fact is, you may have found this, but if you're successful at this point, are you successful? How are you doing?
We're in our third year now, and we're probably right around break even. So hopefully this year we'll move to the more profitability side, which is unusual actually for the distilling world. But I'd like to see this pass on as a legacy if there's some way to make it happen. I may not be there forever, but to find a creative way that this can continue and provide good within that local community.
Yeah, I mean, that's the ironic thing, is that there's nothing antithetical about making a profit and making good product and having a good business and community. In fact, the businesses who have figured that out are actually doing better than the ones that try to squeeze the last nickel out of every employee and every drop of oil on the planet. It's fascinating to see these transformations that even corporations have had when they realize that not filling a pit with toxic waste could mean reducing your toxic waste, and that would save you money. So we're not ecologists at all, but we're actually saving money. So you're talking about moving on already. So you're thinking a little bit about staying, not staying, maybe?
Well, no, it's more the question of, once my mother has passed on, it would be a question of, I don't know if I would stay in Mayberry. It would be, what would be my exit strategy for me personally to move on to wherever the spirit may draw me at that point. And I'm hoping to find a creative way of passing this on either to not only an individual, but perhaps several individuals to continue that legacy, whether it be as a support for a nonprofit or for the local community of Mount Airy or Surrey County in various ways, or even as a teaching place to learn about distilling or hospitality. So I'm looking at all kinds of options right now, and certainly welcome interest from those out there who might have a passion for this and would like to find a way to do some good in the world and share the spirit of Mayberry.
Create a co-op. That's what I say.
It's something I'm going to look into, absolutely.
One guy. What about the transition for you? I mean, obviously you were outside the monastery a great deal, so you were living kind of in the world also as you were a monk. But was it difficult for you to make the transition when you left the monastery?
There were things that were easy and things that were difficult. Because I was very much in the public eye during my last years of the monastery, I had to straddle both worlds. So I had a little bit more ease of moving into the more secular society, if you will. But there were things that I found it difficult to be away from that I did miss. I missed the atmosphere of silence. We're so surrounded by distractions, especially with all our technology today, that finding the quiet moment was not as easy as I had hoped. I think not having the immediate access to nature. Monasteries usually have large properties with, you know, immediate access to being in nature, and that isn't as easy when you're in a more city kind of atmosphere. I do at times, of course, miss the Gregorian chant and that kind of more mystical practice done in community, which I can't do on my own anymore. But I do take time. Morning, midday for a short moment, and then in the evening, really simply to be present. I could be in nature. I could be with my dog, who is listening to this as we speak. I left it on to give him company while I was out. But to find some time for some quiet presence and to welcome whatever whispers of the spirit that the ears of my heart might be able to discern.
The public radio pet. I think we're going to form a support group for pets who have to endure public radio. But I take your point. Has the spirit given you a hint?
I don't know at this point where the next phase will lead. Mm-hmm. But I think it will be continuing in the same tradition of trying to educate others, inspire others, if you will, about ways that not only can they support good things, but ways to be sustainable in their lives.
Have you had that big question and that crisis at the age of six? Do you have a sense now of sort of, obviously you don't have the answer to life, the universe, and everything, although maybe you do, and if you do, you can share it with us now. This would be the moment. But do you have a better sense of sort of how to manage that anxiety that you have?
I do. I've learned how to accept that, we have limited time. We have opportunities put before us because of our life situation, whatever they may be, and taking any of those and giving ourselves to it to seek the good of others around us, to learn more and to simply delight and wonder. That's very much part of the human condition. And I've learned to be comfortable and walk in that sphere with whatever's around me.
You know, this idea of seeking the good, people talk about it all the time, and particularly when these sort of philosophical conversations, I just want to be a good person, they say. But it seems to me that getting to the point of understanding what you mean by good, because if it becomes the thing that is everything that isn't bad, you've set up this polarity again, and that tension is going to create as much hardship in your own life as any other. How do you get to the point where goodness is a part of oneness, this very strange idea that as long as the other person is bad or that thing that I did was bad, there's going to be a separation and we'll never feel a sense of real compassion, another sense of oneness, even with the person we know is wrong?
I think our journeys, in each of us as human beings on the planet, are all ultimately trying to find that integration of head and heart that helps us to understand the true, the good, the beautiful, and the one. And I think in particular, all of the ascetic traditions, the monastic traditions, if you will, of the various religions, all aim at that. And I feel very much more at one with them than perhaps with the general population, because wherever I'm at, light and beauty and goodness is never overshadowed by the darkness. The darkness is there as something that we can transform into something good. And I think that's what we're all supposed to do, is to take that darkness and try and bring it into the light.
But do you have a sense of that's what we are all supposed to do? And then I think we all run afoul of this, trying to get the rest of the world to figure that out and come along with us. Do you have any sense of mission, any sense of trying to bring this curiosity that you had that would lead to the sense and what you have learned to a very distracted world? Is that any part of your mission?
Very much so, Frank. And I think you've really hit on it for me, for my long-term future, is more of trying to share what I've been allowed to experience and to grow in, and to show others that there is a beautiful and peaceful way of taking whatever's around us, whatever our situations, good or bad, wherever we may live, and to find ways of becoming not only a better person ourselves, but to help everyone around us to become better as well.
Great stuff. Van McCoy, the owner of Mayberry Spirits. It is in Mount Airy, North Carolina. And you can find out more about Van and everything we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. Van, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much,
Frank, and all the best to everyone.
Thank you. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wodarski sitting in today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.